with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota. Online at ampers.org.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. I'm Gracie J. State legislators are in their third week of session at the Capitol in the second year of the 2025-2026 biennium, with an evenly divided House where most votes fall along party lines. In this week's program, we look at a bill that would penalize certain protests outside private homes, and we hear how cultural differences can make everyday financial tasks more complicated for immigrant communities. But first, here are some of the top stories from around the state. The state grain is at the heart of a contentious debate, and some lawmakers are trying to protect it. Wild rice is more than just a plant to Native Americans. For the Anishinaabe, it's literally a relative. A new bill would codify that relationship into law by officially recognizing the inherent right of uncultivated wild rice to exist and thrive in Minnesota. But for some lawmakers and state nature officials, that's a step too far.
Here's where we are trying to extend rights of people to rights of other beings, to plants and animals, which seems just very eccentric to me.
Senator Steve Drazkowski says the bill would open the state up to lawsuits and suggested that the state would have to police wild rice even from animals. Senator Mary Kunish, who introduced the bill, says it would do no such thing. The bill would also add the Dakota and Ojibwe names for wild rice, Basheen and Manuman, to the statute. She says that's in line with the state's identity. Ultimately, the committee passed the bill along for further consideration. While tensions came to a head at the Minnewashne prayer camp at Fort Snelling, leaders from several Dakota and Lakota tribes from Minnesota and surrounding states demanded an end to the camp, and the National Park Service ordered members to leave. Since it went up nearly a month ago, several Dakota tribes have sent official letters to the National Park Service denouncing the camp, saying that it threatens years of restoration efforts and that it is situated atop burial mounds. Last week, tribal delegates approached the camp for the first time. One of the camp leaders, Alan Michael Owen, says that
this is a fight for religious freedom and the restoration of a ceremonial ground to be held in whoever's trust. I don't seek to own this land, and none of us do.
At the end, members reached an agreement with a Lakota spiritual leader. Orville Looking Horse, keeper of the sacred white buffalo calf pipe and bundle, met to negotiate the camp's end. They agreed to end the camp after completing four more days of uninterrupted prayer. While Minnesota's farming industry is struggling, the state lost about 1,300 farms in the past year, according to recent Farm Bureau reports. Data shows farm bankruptcies are climbing. Iowa led the Midwest states with 18 filings. Minnesota wasn't far behind with 13. Minnesota lawmakers are considering a bill that would stop most pet stores from selling dogs and cats. Senator Scott Dibble says the bill will help stop some forms of animal cruelty.
A lot of times these businesses are associated with, I said before, sick animals, hidden veterinary costs, and very opaque supply chains.
The proposal would ban new pet shops from selling animals purchased from large volume-driven breeders, though existing stores could continue buying and selling the puppy mill puppies. Stores would have to buy animals from state or federally licensed breeders and disclose breeder license numbers. Pet stores could still host nonprofit adoptions, but could not own the animals or collect a fee. Protests and demonstrations are a core part of American civic life, and here in Minnesota, high-profile marches from the aftermath of George Floyd's killing to more recent rallies over federal policy have drawn national attention. Now, some state lawmakers are pushing legislation that would tighten rules around certain protest tactics and create new penalties for actions they say cross the line. Reporter Jose Osoria has the story.
In recent years, we've seen a troubling trend. Coercive agitators cloaked in the guise of activism deliberately targeting private residences, not to persuade, not to make a credible argument, but to intimidate the individuals and families who reside there.
That's Representative Walter Hudson, who represents District 30A, a suburb northwest of downtown Minneapolis. Representative Hudson is one of the authors of the residential protesting bill currently being considered by the state legislature. Speaking before the Public Safety Committee, Representative Hudson makes the argument that someone's home should have established protections.
There are constitutionally recognized and longstanding time, place, and manner restrictions, and one of those restrictions properly ought to be each of our homes.
Along with the societal and legal reasons behind his push for this bill, Hudson describes the very personal reasons why he co-authored this bill, as his home was recently targeted for protest.
Showing up to somebody's house to scare their children, such as what happened to me last Friday, where I wasn't home for a couple of minutes. I was a couple blocks away, and I get a frantic call from my kid, and he's clutching a knife in the kitchen, and I have to direct him to an interior space of the house.
Protesting is protected by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which also allows citizens the right to petition the government to request changes or complain about policies without fear of punishment. Representative Hudson notes that this bill is rooted in current U.S. law.
This approach is firmly grounded in Supreme Court precedent. In Frisbee versus Schultz, the court held that focused picketing at a residence may be prohibited because the home holds a unique place in our constitutional tradition.
So the bill as proposed would make a first offense a misdemeanor. It becomes a gross misdemeanor if the person has a previous conviction for residential protesting or is violating an existing court order. In U.S. law, a gross misdemeanor is more serious than a standard misdemeanor, but less severe than a felony. The bill has drawn the attention of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota, an organization that's devoted to preserving the rights and liberties enshrined in our Constitution and law. The ACLU wrote a letter to the House Public Safety Committee expressing, quote, "To prohibit protests outside of residential areas is restrictive and unnecessary," end quote.
This bill would essentially ban residential protesting of any kind outside someone's home.
Munira Muhammad is the policy associate with the American Civil Liberties Union and the author of the letter that was sent to the House Public Safety Committee on behalf of the ACLU. Ms. Muhammad says the law very clearly defines what can and can't be done while protesting in a residential area.
If people are assembling and protesting in a way that is not breaking any underlying laws, that I think would be within the realm of First Amendment protections. If that conduct then changes into something that's violent or intimidating, that would then be outside of the realms of First Amendment protected activity.
Ms. Muhammad notes that the bill appears to be a solution in search of a problem.
There's already laws on the books that would get at what the bill is concerned with, which is coercion, harassment, intimidation.
And for the ACLU, this bill is highly problematic because the wording is vague and does not touch upon some very specific details for enforcement.
There is no exact feet given or any kind of measurements of actual location distance. That kind of broad language, it could be interpreted any number of ways and perhaps interpreted in a lot of bad faith ways.
Opponents of the bill are asking if federal agents' actions during Operation Metro Surge should also be considered in the legislation.
As a person who was followed by ICE to my home that they looked up,
during the committee hearing debating the proposed protest bill, Representative Athena Hollins of District 66B asked a very specific question of Representative Hudson, co-author of the bill.
This is something that they were doing to intimidate me, and I am curious if what you are putting into law or what you are hoping to put into law would apply to federal agents.
To this question, Hudson had a very clear response.
The state of Minnesota has no jurisdiction to place restrictions upon the activity of federal law enforcement officers.
Munira Muhammad says the ACLU finds it surprising that this bill focuses only on the actions of the community.
This bill is targeted at just really everyday people who want to protest and not against federal agents who have actually been assaulting people and abusing people. I think it's quite shocking.
Another version of this bill was introduced by Minnesota's GOP last session. The motivation behind the bill at the time was a 2020 protest outside of the home of former Minneapolis Police Federation President Bob Crawl and conservative journalist Liz Collins in the wake of George Floyd's murder. Representative Hudson, co-author of the residential protesting bill, has indicated a willingness to work with those who oppose the bill. During the committee hearing, Representative Sandra Feist, who represents District 39B, suggested amending the language on existing legislation.
Rather than this very broad language, I think that we could amend the existing harassment statute to try to achieve your goals.
His response?
Thank you, Representative Feist. It's an intriguing idea. Let's talk about it.
While there are significant Republican lawmakers who support the bill, many believe that due to the split control of the Minnesota legislature, this bill's passage is unlikely. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
State legislators have introduced anti-protest bills multiple times, with recent efforts targeting disruptive tactics such as blocking highways, airport access roads, and transit lines. Following the murder of George Floyd, several bills were introduced to increase penalties for protests. And already existing federal law protects private homes from protests. To understand more about this topic, we are joined by Professor Jane E. Kirtley, who directs the Silla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Welcome back to North Star Stories.
Thank you, Grace.
So the U.S. has a long history of protests at symbolic locations, from lunch counters to state capitals. Why is the ability to visibly protest so important in democracy?
It has the effect of allowing ordinary individuals to make their feelings heard by the people that could change policy, could change law. I'm thinking about the protest against Target, the boycott, and that is a classic example of expressing a viewpoint in an economic way that ultimately changes policy.
How does protesting outside an elected official's home fit into actions protected under the First Amendment, and where do courts usually draw the line?
It's tricky when you're talking about a residential protest. We certainly have, under the First Amendment, a right to protest on public sidewalks, for example, or other kinds of public places. Once you go onto private property, however, you no longer have that right unless the owner consents to your presence. What makes residential protests even more complicated is the fact that there's a long line of Supreme Court cases that recognizes that the owners or residents of private property have a right to what is called quiet enjoyment. So it's a principle that affects both government actors and non-governmental actors. So when we're talking about government actors, in my opinion, there is a stronger argument to be made that protesting in a place where you are likely to reach them is an important part of that democratic process.
You know, supporters of this bill say it's about protecting families in their homes, while opponents warn it could chill free speech. Legally and practically, what do you think would change for ordinary people who want to protest if this bill becomes law?
Well, one of the questions that the U.S. Supreme Court always asks is, are there alternative channels with which you can communicate your viewpoint? And they would probably say that you don't need to protest outside of someone's home. You can protest at the legislature or at their place of work or someplace else. And those are categories of locations that this bill would seem to permit. Again, it's focusing on the home. So I think the question really becomes, what are you trying to accomplish by protesting outside of someone's home? The key, I think, to this issue is simply this. You can't hold somebody hostage inside of their house. You cannot intimidate them or put them in fear of their safety or their children's safety. There's already existing laws that deal with that. And so the necessity for a law like this is really hard for me to fathom, quite honestly.
So I'm curious, what message does it send when restrictions fall mainly on community protesters and not on government actors? And how might that affect public trust?
I think that's a really important question, especially after what was experienced here in the Twin Cities during the ICE surge. Many people saw intrusions into their neighborhoods, into their homes, if they were in, for example, multifamily dwellings, as government overreach. And now you could say that if that kind of activity is condoned or allowed to continue, or we're told we don't have any way to fight back against it, it becomes really ironic to think that ordinary people who are simply trying to express their viewpoints would be restricted from engaging in activity that is far less problematic, far less dangerous, certainly, and far less likely to impose any real threat to security. I think it is frankly based on viewpoint discrimination which is the most problematic kind of discrimination under the First Amendment. Government cannot pick and choose which viewpoints it's going to endorse, at least when it comes to the exercise of First Amendment rights.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us and sharing your insight with us, Professor Kirtley.
Thank you.
After the break, how many Minnesotans navigate financial decisions while keeping their cultural and faith traditions. This is North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, produced by Ampers with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Check out our other programs at ampers.org. Minnesota Native News brings you weekly coverage of the state's Native American communities. MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds, transports you to historical moments in our state through short, engaging stories. Native Lights, Where Indigenous Voices Shine, is a weekly podcast featuring conversations between Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe members and siblings Leah Lem and Cole Primo and Native community members. Hear more at ampers.org.
You are listening to North Star Stories. I'm Gracie J. In other news from across the state, Minnesota lawmakers are moving ahead with a plan to allow tightly regulated therapeutic use of psilocybin, a naturally occurring psychedelic compound found in over 200 species of mushrooms for adults 21 and older. The House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee has approved a bill that would let qualified patients receive psilocybin-assisted therapy. This type of therapy involves using the psychoactive compound in magic mushrooms in combination with psychotherapy to treat mental health conditions like depression, anxiety, PTSD, and addiction. During the hearing, Stefan Egan, an Army veteran, said,
"Unlike many of my brothers and sisters in arms, I was provided with the opportunity to use psilocybin in a therapeutic manner, albeit from the illicit market, but therapeutic nonetheless. Without that access, I wouldn't be here. Those brain lesions healed, brain cells reconnected, and I could function."
The Department of Health and the Office of Cannabis Management would oversee the program with guidance from a new psychedelic medicine advisory committee. A Minnesota poultry company that went bankrupt is now facing a fine after more than a million chickens were left without feed on contract farms in Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Pure Prairie Poultry filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy in 2024, and that year stopped delivering feed or picking up birds it owned. A Wisconsin judge found the company guilty on 30 counts of animal mistreatment and ordered a $13,575 fine, though it's unclear who can pay it. Next, for many new immigrants, the process of cultural assimilation includes learning different ways to perform routine everyday tasks so they align with the culture and religious beliefs. Reporter Faya Adam explores how Islamic financing is creating new pathways to home and car ownership for Muslim communities while staying aligned with faith.
In the United States, interest rates are built into nearly every major financial transaction. So what does that mean for Muslims who can't receive or pay interest but are trying to build wealth in Minnesota? When Siham Mahmoud bought her first home, she says the hardest part was finding professionals who understood Islamic financing.
I am a real estate agent with Keller Williams Premier Realty. I have been an agent since 2020. What got me into the industry is I purchased my own home and I just didn't have the best. It's not that I didn't have the best experience. I just feel like the people I was working with wasn't well educated in Islamic financing. And that's one of the things that was a non-negotiable for me.
Rather than issuing a conventional loan, banks will structure the financing as a sale or partnership, which allows it to meet federal regulations without charging interest.
I think because everyone thinks real estate is haram, and it obviously interest is haram, and I feel like it's just kind of bridging the gap of explaining how it's halal and what is the differences between the traditional bank and the Islamic financing banks.
There are two common models Islamic banks use. One is called murabaha, which is when the bank purchases the home first, adds an agreed upon profit, and then sells it to the buyer at that fixed price. The other is musharaka, a partnership model where the bank and buyer co-own the property, and the buyer gradually purchases the bank's share over time.
In terms of like credit checks, in terms of taxes, pay stubs, like things that are required from a regular bank, Islamic financing is also going to require that.
One of the institutions offering this type of financing nationwide is University Islamic Financial Corporation, often known as UIF, a faith-based subsidiary of University Bank. Jamil Ahmed, a UIF district manager, explained that from a numbers perspective, the payments can look similar to a conventional mortgage.
We follow Fannie and Freddie Mac guidelines to approve a customer, meaning we check credit, we check income, we check down payment, just like any conventional bank does.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are government-backed companies that buy mortgages from lenders and set many of the standards for conventional home loans. He says the distinction lies in the contract language and structure.
When you're buying a house, what is allowed is a million-dollar question, and what is not allowed, right? So signing a contract saying I'll pay interest is not allowed. Signing a contract saying you're buying a house at an agreed-upon price is allowed.
For Siham Mahamud, the key to home ownership is education. She says she's seen a noticeable increase in first-time home buyers, especially among immigrant families who have previously hesitated.
I feel like at the very beginning, I was convincing people to like what their options are. And now I feel like I do a lot less convincing. I feel like people are going to seminars with Islamic financing. They have webinars. They've made it so easily accessible that I don't have to do as much convincing.
The same faith considerations against paying or charging interest apply when buying a car. Alvez Khan works at a Luther dealership in Minnesota. He says many Muslim customers come to him asking him how they can avoid interest.
Yeah, I started getting a lot of Muslims, a lot of Somali customers. So I went up to my dealership. I was like, you know, I have a market over here available who's willing to buy the cars, but we cannot do interest.
Han says there are two main paths to zero-interest car purchases. First, some manufacturers occasionally offer promotional 0% financing. Second, dealerships can buy down the interest rate, meaning they reduce it to 0% by sacrificing profit on the deal.
If I tell you, 99% of my 0% deals that I do, I barely make any money. I mean, the dealership barely makes any money.
The dealership will typically make money through selling other products to buyers.
I will sell you warranties. This is how I kind of cover up the dealership. You know, I lose money at the front of the vehicle. I lose money on the vehicle, but I make money on the back. But there's an if on it that if you buy the warranties from me. So it is not 100% of the time.
There are also limitations with these cars, such as buyers typically needing very good credit above 740 and repayment terms are shorter than conventional loans. Still, Han says word spreads quickly and he's selling 30 to 40 cars a month.
I am very black and white when it comes to upfront paperwork with my customers. I tell them, hey, listen, go through all the numbers. If you see any traces of riba on it, let me know. You know, we will make sure that it's not there.
For many Muslims in Minnesota, avoiding interest isn't just a financial choice. It's a religious one. An estate where owning a car is often essential and home ownership is a pathway to stability, Islamic financing is becoming more normalized. For North Star Stories, I'm Faya Adam.
Like the Muslim community, other immigrants in the state accommodate their traditions and use their cultural knowledge to navigate their finances. To learn more about this, we are joined now by Miguel Quiñones, a PhD candidate in family social science at the University of Minnesota, studying financial acculturation in immigrant families. Thank you so much for joining us today, Miguel.
Yes, thank you for the introduction and for having me.
So many immigrant communities bring financial practices rooted in culture or faith. From an economic perspective, how do these alternative systems fit within the mainstream U.S. banking model?
Historically, those alternative financial systems, they have not fit really well within the systems that we have in the U.S., but with recent advancements in technology, but also awareness, they're starting to create more space for those systems. For example, like the zero interest financing options, as well as lending circles that most often occur informally among communities. I'm starting to see some institutions who offer products that are similar and function similarly to lending circles, but that operate under the protection of the institution.
Miguel, how does a lending circle work?
So a lending circle is where several people who trust each other, usually in the same community or family, come together and they pool their resources to support one person who has a need. And so they come together for a couple weeks, and each week, for example, they might all contribute $500. And that pool of money goes to one person that week, and the next week they do it all over again. But each week it goes to a different person in the lending circle, so that by the time it ends, every person has had a chance to get that lump sum of money, and there has been no interest accrued on that.
When immigrant families use non-traditional tools to buy homes or cars, how does that shape their ability to build wealth compared with conventional credit and loans?
When they use these different systems, they can definitely help families build assets, but that may not always translate into something measurable like a credit history. For example, families might live together, multiple families in one household, and they do this strategy where they help pay off the home right away, and then once it's paid off, they move on to help another family member buy another home. And that might be really good to help families build equity faster and to reduce that debt burden quicker. But sometimes that means that only one person's name is on the mortgage, or it means that others are contributing financially and they're demonstrating that they can and they are creditworthy, but there's no paper trail for that.
So then what could banks, credit unions, and policymakers do differently to recognize and support culturally rooted financial systems among immigrant communities while still managing risk and regulation?
I think the solution is definitely recognition and then adaptation. And that looks a lot of different ways. For example, the bank or the institution, it might be beneficial for them to have a cultural intermediary, someone who exists in between the bank and the community. But also building on that, I think it's going to require different innovations in the products and services that banks and institutions offer that recognize these more culturally rooted practices and figures out how to incorporate them into their traditional offerings.
Well, thank you so much, Miguel. That's all the time we have. And lastly, Minnesota's Geechee-Gami State Trail is getting national attention. It's been nominated for USA Today's 10 Best Reader's Choice Award for Best Recreational Trail. The paved trail, built and managed by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, currently stretches about 36 miles along the North Shore, connecting towns like Silver Bay, Schroeder, Lutzen, and Grand Marais with Big Lake Superior views and access to several state parks. When it's finished, the trail is expected to run about 86 miles from Two Harbors to Grand Marais as a non-motorized route for biking, walking, and more. Fans of the trail can vote for the Geechee-Gami once a day through April 6th on the USA Today's 10 Best website. This is it for today's program. If you missed any part of today's newscast, you can find this and past episodes at ampers.org or listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get North Star Stories daily on our website or check your favorite station's schedule. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with more stories and voices from the North Star State.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, the closing of a longtime fabric store is inspiring efforts to keep sewing and craft traditions alive, and Red Lake Tribal Nation continues its expansion into Minnesota's off-reservation cannabis market. First, producer Deanna Standing Cloud brings us a story about how community members are finding creative ways to preserve their sewing and crafting practices.
For many Indigenous people in Minnesota, crafting and sewing is a way to preserve culture, heal from trauma, and connect to their relatives. As Little Earth of United Tribes in Minneapolis gears up for its annual Mother's Day powwow, residents of a community sewing group are finding ways to be creative after the closing of Joann Fabrics.
As we always went there, I always used there. They had good coupons. Right now, it's real hard to find.
Terry Broker is a citizen of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. She's been attending the Little Earth Sewing and Beading Group for over 3 years.
Joann Fabrics impacted us. Joann is such a big store that they have everything that we need.
Charlene New is Oglala Lakota from the Pine Ridge Reservation. She's been a part of the Little Earth Sewing and Beading Group for 2 years.
Never in my life would I have thought that a store closing, I would have felt deflated.
After the closing of the last Joann Fabric store in May 2025, a Native-owned small business is entering the void.
For those that are coming into our shop, it's kind of like home. So it's a way to be proud of who you are and where you come from.
Jessica Travis is from Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux. She's one of the co-owners of Fire Mountain Fabrics in Osseo, Minnesota. Jessica and her co-owner, Arlene Fairbanks, who is Danae from Arizona, offers sewers and crafters supplies